ascoltando i podcast di Radio Bue, la web radio degli studenti dell'Università di Padova, www.radiobue.it.
Good morning. As we said last week, the next topic of our inquiry is the third article of the Constitution dealing with the judicial power. In Philadelphia, during the works of the convention, there was much discussion about the executive power. As I told you, the position of the president was by no means an easy issue to solve. The composition of Congress was a very difficult matter as well. You would remember that the composition of the Senate was a great issue. However, the existence of the judicial power and its tasks was a matter which attracted less interest, less attention, and less controversy in Philadelphia. The article is like that. The judicial power of the United States shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. The judges, both on the supreme and inferior courts, shall hold their offices during good behavior and shall, at stated times, receive for their services a compensation which shall not be diminished during their continuance in office. So this is the article, and you may notice that there are several interesting things. For example, the fact that the judicial system was built from top to the bottom, not vice versa. The article says the judicial power shall be vested in one Supreme Court and in such inferior courts as the Congress may from time to time ordain and establish. And this expression from time to time sounds even bizarre. It's like Congress could sometime create tribunals and some other times abolish them. It gives strange feelings that the founding fathers didn't really think to the matter. As a matter of fact, the construction, the building of the federal justice system took many decades. And it was only slowly that the composition of the court, its tasks, and the composition of the other federal appeal courts were settled. For example, you may know that the Supreme Court now has 9 justices. However, this number is not prescribed by the Constitution, and Congress could well decide that the composition of the court should be not 9, but 5, 15, even 50 judges. This is not a matter which is settled by the Constitution. And in a matter of fact, the 30s, President Roosevelt tried to enlarge the composition of the court, of course for political reasons, and there was a plan to basically double the number of Supreme Justices, but the the plan died in the Senate, and the composition of the court at 9 members is more or less fixed forever. It should be a coup d'etat for the Congress to change the composition of the court. But this is not the only power Congress has. For example, Congress may fix the dates for the Supreme Court to be in session. Today, the court has two sessions, one in the spring and the other in the fall. But this is not fixed by the law as well. And there have been times when Congress prescribed the court to have only one session per year. This, of course, was a political maneuver as well. But nevertheless, the existence of two sessions every year is not prescribed by any law. What does the Supreme Court do? This is the section 2 of the same article, which says, "The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority, to all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, to controversies to which the United States shall be a party, to controversies between two or more states, between a state and a citizen of another state, between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, and between a state or the citizen thereof and foreign states, citizen or subjects." This enumeration is rather boring today, because the great majority of cases treated by the Supreme Court deal with an entire different matter, not with consuls and ambassadors, not controversies between a state and another state, but 90% of the work of the Supreme Court today is the review of constitutionality of the laws. That is, the Supreme Court main task today, and it has been so for quite a while, is to decide whether a federal or a state law are constitutional. This is interesting because it's not 100% clear that the delegates in Philadelphia had this in mind when they created the Supreme Court. As you see, there are some tasks of the court which are clearly a matter for those days. For example, the controversies between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states. This is clearly before the West was colonized, and it's a case related to competing claims by two different of the original 13 states on the same area, which was at that time not inhabited, or inhabited by native Americans who had no say in Congress or in Philadelphia. And also the other cases enumerated, ambassadors, the law of the sea, maritime jurisdiction and so forth. All these cases appeared to be important at that time. They are much less today. They are much less today because the first part of this section, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this constitution, these three lines became the focus of the work of the Supreme Court and also the focus of a great deal of political trouble in the last 50 years at least. Why is that? First of all, we should know what they mean with law and equity, because the meaning of these words is not obvious. Law here means common law, which is the legal system of Great Britain, and it still is. And common law is a legal system which is different from the legal systems of continental Europe, because it's not a system based on a corpus of predetermined law or principle of law which are settled forever. It's more a system based on judges' sentences and precedents. Precedents means older sentences by the judges. So it's a kind of accumulated wisdom in the legal system, and it's not a formal system like the Roman law, which is the base for all legal system in continental Europe. And the two systems are quite different. Are different the procedures, the rights of the accused, the importance of precedents, and so forth. So here, law means common law, and equity is the other system, the parallel system in Great Britain. The parties had the right to ask the judge to be judged under the equity system, which was a separated system more similar to the Roman law. And this is the reason why the two things are both mentioned in the article, because the American legal system is a blend of the two systems. So common law is an English system, and equity refers to the Roman law as it was developed in continental Europe. Both things, both systems, however, are arising under this constitution. And this expression, arising under this constitution, is the basis for what has been known since the Philadelphia Convention as the power of judicial review. The entire system, the check if a law is constitutional or is not, is called the power of judicial review of congressional bills after they are enacted. The judicial review is today a matter which was settled by a number of cases starting in the 50s. Probably the most important case which started a phase of a very active judicial control on politics is called Brown versus Board of Education. It's a case of 1954. And Brown was the case when the Supreme Court decided that segregation in schools were not constitutional. As you may know, after the Civil War, the reconstruction of the Union had indeed the liberation of former slaves from their servitude, but Afro-Americans were not given the same rights of white citizens. Much to the contrary, they were discriminated in various ways. For example, public places were segregated by race, train cars, restaurants, even public fountains were segregated by race, and of course schools were segregated by race as well. And it took this sentence of 1954, that is almost a century after the Civil War, for the Supreme Court to declare that segregation per se was unconstitutional, even if in the Constitution there was no explicit article dealing with this topic. But Brown was important because it affirmed the will of the Supreme Court to enter very hot political questions. At that time, segregation was a divisive issue. Southern states were determined to defend it. There were governors of Alabama, Mississippi, and other southern states leading marches, demonstrations against this sentence. And there were cases when the federal government had to send troops to the states, as it happened in 1958 in Little Rock, Arkansas. And at that time, the Eisenhower administration had to send federal troops to protect the right of two students to enter a non-segregated school, because they were threatened in every possible way. But what is interesting for us is the fact that the court in the 50s and in the 60s decided to enter a great deal of very important political questions. Segregation was one. The second big one, which is a hot political topic even today, is abortion. The right to interrupt, to have an abortion, was established by a sentence of the Supreme Court called Roe versus Wade in 1973. And this was a sentence striking down, declaring unconstitutional, a law in Texas which limited the right of women to obtain a lawful abortion. Roe versus Wade was justified, was explained by the sentence of the court with a strange legal argument. The majority of the court decided that the right of abortion was part of implicit rights in the Constitution, namely the right to privacy. The justices said that a personal choice as important as, for a woman as an abortion should be protected by the interference of government. That is, this kind of choice is too personal, too important, too fundamental for having government meddling with it, and therefore the right of a woman to choose whether to finish her pregnancy or not was protected by the right to privacy, which is implicit in the Constitution. Of course, this interpretation of the Constitution is perfectly reasonable, probably extremely wise. But nevertheless, it's a very difficult problem when a Supreme Court decides in such a matter. Because abortion, like many other fundamental topics, like peace and war, or the right to die, today. These topics are so sensitive for a society that they should, in my mind, always be decided by political bodies. That is, if there is a Congress elected by citizens, it is Congress that should decide on such matters. Because democracy functions this way. The citizens have opinions, these opinions contribute to their choices of representatives and senators, and a majority of representatives and senators should decide what is the law of the land. I'm practically certain that Congress would have decided in not very wise way the controversy about abortion, because it's a topic on which the United States public opinion is split right in the middle. Basically, 50% of Americans are favor of choice, and 50% are against, or at least they are in favor of the freedom to have abortions with some limitations, for example, for women under age or things like that. But nevertheless, even if the Supreme Court has been wiser and more far-sighted in deciding this topic, the very fact that it was decided by 9 justices who are not elected but appointed, they are not accountable to any other institution of the government. The Supreme Court has the final word on all laws. The constitution is the supreme law of the land, and therefore the way the justices interpret the constitution is the final say on the matter. This way of deciding important political matters like abortion, in my mind, has not been politically wise. This is, of course, an issue, the power of constitutional courts, that exists in other countries as well. If you read Italian newspapers last week, there were controversies around the decision of our constitutional court. And all these controversies and polemics are based on the same issue: how far a constitutional court should go in deciding political questions that should belong to elected bodies. The answer of the American Supreme Court is basically that there are no bounds. The word, the voice of the Supreme Court goes everywhere, even in minuscule details of the law. For example, another issue which has been tremendously important in the United States during the 70s was the so-called busing. Busing means to put on a bus the young students and transport them to another neighborhood in a school which is different from the school of the neighborhood where they live. And why busing is necessary, why this kind of cumbersome procedure was adopted. It was adopted because of the Supreme Court decision about segregation. Of course, you can forbid a public institution like a school or even a restaurant from formally exclude from the premises some customers because of their race. But if you have a black neighborhood, the 100% of the elementary school children will be black in the neighborhood school. This is obvious. So to have a remedy to the segregation by neighborhoods, that is public schools 100% white in white neighborhoods and 100% black in black neighborhoods, the Supreme Court invented this system of transferring part of the students from one school to another in order to have mixed school everywhere. The problem with this solution is not the fact that it made no sense. In some way, it made sense. It confronted a real problem, goal was probably with merit to have schools that are not segregated. However, entering in the details of the solutions was probably not the task of the Supreme Court, because entering into the solution of a political problem is more the task of politically elected bodies or agencies, the schools, the school systems themselves, and so forth. So the American Supreme Court entered into a political domain much more extended than the constitutional courts in Italy or France or Germany used to enter. The American Supreme Court deals with a number of problems that in Europe are not settled by the justice system, but are settled by the political system. In all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers and consuls, and those in which a state shall be a party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction. In all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Now, the most important part of the work of the Supreme Court is its appellate jurisdiction, because Congress during the two centuries created a federal court system, and so the normal way to have a controversy decided in the United States is that if there is the case in Massachusetts, that goes to the courts of Massachusetts, and then maybe to the Supreme Court of Massachusetts. If there is a federal interest in the matter, the federal appeal courts for the region of Massachusetts will deal with that. And if one of the party wants to appeal the judgment of the federal court, it can go to the Supreme Court, except for the fact that the Supreme Court can decide which cases to accept and which not to accept. This is very different from what happens in France or in Italy, because if there is an appeal to our constitutional court, the constitutional court will take it. Maybe just to say we don't think this is important, and so we decide to let the things stay as they are, but it will automatically go to the constitutional court. And in fact, our constitutional court is much larger than the Supreme Court in the US. In the US, the Supreme Court can decide it doesn't take a case because they think that there are no important constitutional issues to decide. And in this event, the matters stand where the federal court leaves them. The trial of all crimes, except in cases of impeachment, shall be by jury, and such trial shall be held in the state where the crimes shall have been committed, but when not committed within any state, the trial shall be at such place or places as the Congress may by law have directed. When not committed within any state means on the sea, basically. And so it's not a point which is very important today. The important point in this comma is that the trial of all crimes shall be by jury. The jury is an institution of the common law. Jury is a panel of 6, 9, 12 jurors, and they have the task to decide if the person who is indicted, who is under trial, is guilty or is innocent. If you have seen any legal TV series, you know about this. The jury is an interesting problem because it's a system based on common law, which is completely different from what happens in our courts. There are some crimes, for example, homicide, in which also in Italy you have a number of jurors, if I'm not mistaken, 6. But there are also 3 professional judges, and they decide together. So the professional judges and the popular jurors are blended in the same court, and that happens in Italy only for very important crimes like homicide or kidnapping and so forth. The common law system, which was created in England and then arrived in the United States, is completely different. First of all, you have a right to have a jury of people like you. And this right is considered not a procedure issue, it's not a matter for the legal system, it is considered in the United States a pillar of American liberties. That is a political question. Under the Constitution, the government simply cannot decide that trials for reasons of economy or speed or whatever should be conducted by professional justice. This is simply not possible because the Constitution prescribes a trial by jury. So every time you are under trial, not for really trivial matters, any substantial question for which you are under trial in the US, you must have a jury. And the jury has some limitations, which are different from what happens in Europe. For example, the task of the jury is to decide about guilty or not guilty. But the one who presides the trial is the judge, which is a different figure. Again, if you look at the TV series, it is the judge that who rules about what the evidence can be, what the lawyers can say, how many witnesses should be listened to, and so forth. So the judge is the one who rules the court and makes the decision about how the trial should be conducted. The jury has only the task to listen what happens in the courtroom, listen to the witnesses, listen to the lawyers, and then decide. The sentence, if one is guilty, the sentence is again a matter for the judge. So you have again a separation of powers here. The judge rules the trial and pronounces the sentence. The jury has only the task to decide if someone is guilty or not guilty. But what is interesting in this institution is the fact that the jury has much wider powers than a judge in Italy or elsewhere in the world. For example, suppose that you sell cocaine and you are arrested. The law in European countries prescribe that you should be sentenced if there are witnesses and evidence that you indeed sold cocaine, at least 3 years behind bars, and a maximum of suppose 7 years if you have a big quantity of the drug. So at your trial, the judge, if he decides that there is enough evidence that you indeed sold cocaine, can give you a sentence between 3 and 7 years in jail. And this is his power. He cannot say, I'll sentence you to 8 years or 2 years, because there are guidelines to which he should adhere. The power of a jury is different. A jury in the United States can, quote, nullify, unquote, the law. That is, they can decide that cocaine should be free, for example, should be available to all those who want to consume it. And therefore, even if the person on trial is technically guilty, they can set him free. And at the same time, they can they cannot give him more than 7 years as prescribed by the guidelines, because this is the province of the judge, but they can nevertheless ask the judge to give a harsh sentence, the maximum which is possible, because they think that this crime, selling cocaine, is particularly important, is such a dangerous thing for the society that someone should be put behind bars forever, for example. So the power of the jury is different from what it is the power of judges in Europe. And in the United States remains what is called a liberty guarantee. That is, they think that under the Constitution, the right to be judged by your peers, people of the same neighborhood where you committed the crime, is a fundamental defense against the oppression of government. Except in cases of impeachment, we already discussed that the cases of impeachment are prescribed by the Constitution. It's the House of Representatives that can start the proceedings, and it's the Senate which works as a high court to decide about impeachments. Section 3, treason against the United States shall consist only in levying war against them or in adhering to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort. No person shall be convicted of treason unless on the testimony of two witnesses to the same overt act or on confession in open court. Of course, today this sounds rather strange, but in 1787 the issue of treason, that is Section 3 of Article 3, was considered politically very important because there was always the potential danger that the majority of Congress use its power to accuse the minority of treason and persecute them. Actually, after the Constitution was adopted and ratified, the Adams administration, Adams was the second president of the United States after George Washington, in 1798 made a law that passed in Congress called the Sedition Act. And the Sedition Act basically prohibited to say nasty things against the government. It was a censorship law directed against newspapers that were in the opposition to the government. And this sedition law actually was used to put a number of journalists in jail. The law expired in 1800 when there was an election won by the opposition, and Jefferson became president. But nevertheless, the Alien and Sedition Law of 1798 was evidence that the issue of treason was indeed important in the history of the United States. And so the fact that this section gives quite a narrow definition of treason was a wise choice. This section basically says that except if you are in levying war against the United States or helping the enemies, aid and comfort, unless there are these particular circumstances, that is a very narrow set of circumstances, all the rest is not treason. You cannot be accused of treason because of your ideas, and not even because of your acts, unless there are two witnesses for the same overt act or a confession. And in fact, there was a very important treason trial early in the 19th century, because Aaron Burr, who had been the vice president elected in the year 800. When his term finished, made a strange expedition in the southwest, probably trying to help the Spanish or to fight the Spanish and create a separate southwestern republic for himself. Anyway, his strange, quite bizarre political projects ended when he was arrested, and he was put on trial for treason, but there were no witnesses to his actions. He didn't confess, and so he was acquitted. So this article was made to forbid Congress or President to use the accusation of treason as a political weapon.
Stai ascoltando i podcast di Radio Bue, la web radio degli studenti dell'Università di Padova, www.radiobue.it.